Today's show is brought to you by Bogart Extractors, an industry leader in hydrocarbon extraction. Over the last decade, Bogart has implemented many new technologies which have helped to revolutionize the way hydrocarbon extractions are performed. Each unit is made with sanitary stainless steel and is built and tested right here in the USA. Their certified system for use in licensed facility meet all NFPA and ASME standards and undergo peer reviewed by third-party engineers to ensure facilities and its employees can operate safely. Beyond simply making a functional extractor, Bogart has many additional features which make extraction faster and more cost-effective compared to other manufacturers. These features include hydrocarbon failing films to supercharge evaporation rates, heavy-duty explosion-proof pumps for flammable liquids and vapors, industrial chillers capable of maintaining large tanks of solvent at temperatures below 60 Celsius. They also offer extensive tech support and consultation services. So whether you need to set up an extraction lab from scratch or you just need some replacement gaskets, give them a call at 855-553-3887 or check out their website at www.bogart.com.
All right, so getting started, we are back with another deep dive. My name is Mark Rustelli. I'm the CEO of CanTrade and the host of The Hemp Show. This is our deep dive conversation, and today I've got Kent Brown with Witnessing History Education Foundation, and ultimately we just had Kent on our monthly show with our 15-minute segment. We did not have enough time to cover what we were talking about there because, Kent, you are working on a documentary about the history of hemp, right? And we went over that briefly on the 15 minutes, but we have more time now, so I want to dive into everything going on there. So wherever you want to start.
Well, the Witnessing History Education Foundation is designed and its mission is to produce documentary films on American history that can be widely broadcast on public television, PBS affiliates, as well as some cable networks and streaming sites, the purpose being to introduce people all over the world, but mostly Americans, to the history of their country. And we do this in a manner in these films that we believe not only tells the basic story without anything political anywhere. This is the raw story, but in a manner that entertains the average viewer, because that's the person we want to understand history and to like it and enjoy watching it and become interested in it. And so we've made 11 films that cover the waterfront from Henry Clay and the struggle for the Union to retreat from Gettysburg, to the Lincoln family in Kentucky, which is a remarkable story, by the way. And then Abraham Lincoln in Illinois. We're right now in the midst of working on a film. The script has been done and we're acquiring all the imagery for it. And it's a 90-minute film on the coming of the American Revolution, telling people how it came about. And it's a story that, though it covers all the colonies, it is primarily based in Boston, and because there's where it all began. But we are also promoting the idea of producing a film on the history of hemp in America. You know, I became interested in this sort of subject, frankly, growing up in Kentucky. Kentucky, at one point in time in the history of this country, was the largest hemp producing state in the Union. And that was true almost from the beginning of the 19th century until World War I. And other states, of course, produced it. Missouri quickly followed Kentucky in producing it. Illinois did. There was some raised in Indiana and Ohio. Virginia did. There were other states that produced it, but none to the extent that Kentucky did. People have often conjectured as to why Kentucky seemed to be a great producer of that plant. And it probably all boils down to the same answer you give to the distilling industry, which of course is also very big in the old Commonwealth. We deal in all the vices, you know, in Kentucky, horse racing, bourbon.
Yeah, I was gonna say, when you're talking about the distilling industry, we're talking about moonshine, right?
Moonshine, well, yeah. Well, a little better grade than moonshine, although moonshine's big too, but they don't talk about that. That's a big secret. But the reason, I mean, distilling became big was the limestone bed in the soil here. We have an enormous bed of limestone in under the soil in central Kentucky. These are all the counties surrounding Lexington, Fayette County. It covers maybe of the 120 counties, maybe 12 of them are great whiskey producing counties because of the limestone bed. That limestone gives the water that is used in distilling an edge over water anywhere else. If you go through Kentucky's rural countryside, you'll come across beautiful land in central Kentucky, but always you'll see these, what they call here, sinking springs, where the limestone water comes out to the surface and forms a stream, possibly. And the stream goes until it falls down into the limestone bed again. It's the most interesting sort of geological formations you can imagine. But all that is the great contributor to, one, the soil being so good and so well watered. That in turn creates plant life, unlike any others in the country. And so in central Kentucky, you have the distilling industry created because of the water. Then you have the plant life, and hemp is among those that found a home here because of the soil. And it's a deep loam, clay-like soil on top of this limestone bed that is really well watered. It's the reason too that in the early frontier of Kentucky, cane grew so remarkably well here, to the point where cane breaks in central Kentucky were, some of them were 50, were 6 or 7 miles long, 3 and 4 miles wide, just cane. And it's because it needs the water in the soil. Hence, cane is a bamboo type thing, just like hemp is. And hemp grew well here. And it became, for these central Kentucky counties, an immense crop really throughout the entire 19th century.
Excellent. Excellent. So, yes. So I would be curious to know, I mean, I don't know specifically why the limestone does so well. My guess would be it's very porous.
Porous, it is.
So it's very good for water filtration. Right. Also, it probably helps to carry some different minerals in the water.
Lots.
Well, ultimately, while filtering the water, it's also infusing the water with different beneficial nutrients. So I would guess those would be a few reasons that it would do really well there.
In the horse racing business, we of course love to raise horses here, and thoroughbred horses and standard bred horses.
Everybody knows the Kentucky Derby.
Everybody knows that. And, but it's interesting that almost every breeder of thoroughbred horses in America will, whether they live here, if they don't even live in Kentucky, they will graze their horses in Kentucky for a period of time so they can eat the grass. Again, it's what it does to the sinew of that animal, same as it does for cattle. We owe a lot to just the geological formations underneath this state. And hemp was just one of the beneficiaries of this.
Excellent. So you believe that was one of the primary reasons that hemp grew so well in Kentucky?
It just grew so well, yes, exactly.
Large, really large industry. Now, yeah. As far as the documentary, you know, mentioned it's the history of hemp in the U.S. Does it cover prior to the U.S. or does it really start with, you know, hey, here's where hemp started in the U.S. and here's where it expanded and so on?
What I would envision. I haven't written the script yet. That'll come later when we really have the funding in to make this thing. But what I would envision we would do in this is start with some commentary about the origins of hemp. And it is a plant that is native to Asia. However, it's like so much in history, there's a lot we don't know. But we find that the early settlers in Virginia, particularly, referred to a brand of hemp as Indian hemp. And this persisted for many, many years. George Washington he was a hemp grower himself. He referred to a brand called Indian hemp, as did Thomas Jefferson, who also was a hemp producer. Now, there has been some circumstantial evidence that hemp was grown by Native American tribes along the Potomac and along the James River. What that was, we have very little knowledge, but there seems to have been some hemp grown by the Native tribes, at least some of them. So we would start with its Asian origins and this possibility of it being raised by the tribes here in America. But its real introduction to this country was by the English settlers. And those are both settlers of what became Massachusetts, Plymouth Colony, 1620, as well as the earlier colony at Jamestown in 1607. There was even apparently an attempt at growing hemp in Sir Walter Raleigh's colony in North Carolina, the colony that failed. Certainly in Jamestown and in Plymouth, they began raising hemp. And the English, the companies that settled these areas, particularly the company that settled Jamestown, was very interested in the settlers there growing hemp. John Rolfe commented once that one of the prime settlers of Jamestown, that the hemp they raise in America, in Virginia, was as fine a quality as hemp grown in Europe. Now, in England, they didn't raise very much hemp. And you wonder, why does Britain want the settlers in the New World raising hemp? Well, in the 16th century, England became interested in expanding a navy. The other countries, the rivals to England on the continent of Europe, had navies. Britain, being a colony surrounded by oceans, was a natural to become a naval power. And so it began to develop a navy. In order to rig those ships, in order to put sails on those ships, they had to find some fiber, and hemp became the fiber. And up until hemp began to really be grown in America in large quantities, Britain got all of its hemp from the Balkans and from what is now Russia. These were what we would call water-rotted hemp, supposedly the strongest hemp there is. And so Britain was importing it and then making their ropes, their halyards, their rat lines, all those riggings of those ships were made of hemp. And then the sails were made of hemp. So that when they sailed from England to Jamestown, they sailed on a ship that was totally filled with cordage and sails made of hemp. But they were from East Europe for the most part. And so the idea was to get the colonies to supply, if hemp was being raised well here, and it was a good hemp, Then they wanted them and they wanted it in England so that they could use it for the Navy. And it became the principal item necessary for a sailing Navy is hemp. And so it was incredibly valuable to England. No sooner did the settlers come into Jamestown than by 1611, they were requiring settlers to raise hemp. The same thing was true in Plymouth Colony. It was 1633 when they required all the settlers to raise hemp because they could get money for it. Britain would buy it. And then immediately following Plymouth Colony, Connecticut required its settlers to raise hemp. And all of this was for the maritime use of the hemp in the cordage and in the sails for the Navy, for the British Navy.
Wow.
And of course, it ruled the seas at one time.
Were the settlers required to produce other crops as well? Or was hemp one of those ones that was like a must for everybody?
That was a must. That was the one that was a must. It's interesting, in Virginia, as you can imagine, one of the big things they raised there was tobacco. Well, they did here in Kentucky too, and they still do. Although because of the what's happened to cigarettes and smoking tobacco in America, that's diminished considerably. But when I grew up here in central Kentucky, every farm had a hemp patch, a big one.
Wow.
And every November were the hemp sales and the tobacco sales. So, but that's basically gone now. But in the early settlements in Virginia, and then again in Kentucky later, tobacco was the big crop, the big cash crop. Mm-hmm. And it was a hard thing to get the settlers to raise hemp when they could get the money they were getting for tobacco. Yet, that's the reason they required it. You're just going to have to. Yeah. And it's because that's needed, and you can get some money for that, but you can raise your tobacco, but you're going to raise this. So it was mandated.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was a necessity to have the fibrous crop for everything that the maritime and all the boats need.
Exactly right.
Now you mentioned earlier, and I just was curious because I'm not sure what specifically meant, but you mentioned water rotted hemp.
Yes.
Is that the process? How it would?
Hemp. Once the stalks of hemp are cut, and they're cut down close to the ground, it's a very cautious process of cutting hemp. Once they're cut, then they're stacked in these stacks that look like tents, like a teepee. They look like a teepee.
That's exactly what I thought when you started to make that motion.
Yeah, it's just like an Indian teepee. And they're all stacked together, and they remain like that for really until the cool weather starts to come in. And then they are taken down and lay the stalks on the ground for the stalks to absorb the weather, rain, snow. In Russia and in the East European countries where they grow hemp, they call theirs water rotted because in many instances, they actually take the stalks and put them in water, ponds, creeks, whatever. But it's also because of the heavy snows where they just sit in water all the time. And the British Navy always claimed that that's the strongest hemp there is. And they would get it from Russia. But then what happens when Napoleon invades Russia in 1812? Well, all their exports are shut down. So they turn to American products. But anyway, the hemp is laid out, and it literally sits in this dew or dampness until the grower determines that you can now break it, meaning break each stalk so as to retrieve the fiber alone. And what that rotting does is that there's a kind of a gel on the inside that holds that fiber in next to the stalk inside. And you want to break that up. And the way you break it up is through the moisture. And once it gets to the point where that fiber is loose inside that stalk, they bring hemp breaks out to the farm, out to the fields, and they'll literally break those stalks and pull the fiber out of them. It's to a farmer who raises this now, it is a very sensitive process. You've got to hit it just right. You've got to make sure the crop is ready to be cut. You got to make sure that the rotting has succeeded. You can't misjudge any of that, which made grazing this a real science.
Interesting.
Once they gathered up all that fiber, they baled it with respect to the stalks and the remnants of the plant. They just leave them on the ground because all the nutrients of that would then seep back into the soil. One thing they said about hemp is that if you raise it, you can grow another crop just where you planted the crop the year before. And once that crops, you can plant another one there. The soil, it takes a much longer time for the soil to wear out where you're growing hemp than it would for any other plant. And so year after year, they could go back to the same place because of all the nutrients. And ultimately, they burn those hulls of the plant and then scatter that on the ground too. So it's really kind of a remarkable process of growing the plants, and then taking everything from those plants and restoring the soil with them after you take out the fiber itself. So it's a neat thing.
Excellent. And it's a crazy concept, you know, restoring the soil after you ravish it with growing crops. That's excellent. Now you mentioned, so when you mentioned it's like a science, what I was thinking of when you were saying that was very similar to, like, say, winemaking, beer making, even curing cannabis once you get your flowers and you have to cure it and burp it properly and make sure that the moisture leaves it at a certain rate and it stays to a certain humidity. So that's what I thought. It sounds like it's a very similar process where you've got to make sure that you're really following the science and the procedure to the T so that you end up with a good product at the end.
That's right. There have been some people who've written about this. I mean, it's been a long time since we've seen huge hemp produced like you did in the 19th century. But there would be farmers who've raised this all their lives who could just look at that stalk on the ground and tell that thing's ready to be broken and do it. And then there are others who would just have to break a stalk and see whether or not it looked like these were ready to go. So experience helps.
Yeah, that's that farmer. Just like you walk the fields with a farmer in a cannabis grow, and they can just look at each plant and say, oh, that one's ready. You know, that one's close. This one's got three more weeks. You know, based on the pistils, the trichomes, the formation of the colas, and all of those types of things. Yeah. Now, a question for you. What was the alternative in the past to hemp as far as sales and cordage and all of those things? What was the alternative that was used if hemp wasn't used?
Flax, for the most part, at least for clothing, headgear, carpeting, really rugs, throw rugs, bedding. Flax is very much like hemp and is grown very similar way to hemp. And you even break the stalks and pull out the fiber, much like you do with hemp, except it's just not as strong. And so when hemp becomes available, you know, you can really make ropes out of that, where you don't really have that luxury with flax. But yet flax, you know, was raised by the pioneer just like they raised hemp, and it was essential.
So that was going to be my next question, which you started to partially answer, was, in utilizing hemp, did that give, you know, those countries, those individuals, did that give them a technical advantage as far as a stronger sail, a stronger, you know, row, whatever it may be?
Of course it did. Of course it did. And you got to remember, you know, I'm a huge fan of frontier history. When I say frontier, I mean the American frontier up until and through the Revolution. The Kentucky frontier. Those settlers coming into Kentucky in years right before the American Revolution and during the Revolution, like Daniel Boone, Simon Kenton, these people, if you went to any one of their fortified stations, these were the where they had the palisade, wood palisades around blockhouses, all those the fortified stations, there would always be two things growing outside that fort. One was corn, I mean, because they eat it. They need it for whole lots of things. But they would also have crops of hemp because that's where they made their shirts, their coats, their trousers, their hats, their bedding was out of hemp. Then you would see plants of flax. I remember this great scene during the Revolutionary War, a fortified station just outside of town here called Bryan Station. Daniel Boone married Rebecca Bryan. They're all from North Carolina. And Rebecca Bryan's family settled what we call Bryan Station. And in 1782, this is 1 year after Yorktown, there was a British invasion of Kentucky. And they used the Butler's Rangers from New York to lead this. These were provincials. These were native New Yorkers, but who were loyal to the crown. And they referred to them as Butler's Rangers, named for Walter Butler. And this contingent of Butler's Rangers, along with elements of at least six Algonquin-speaking tribes from the Great Lakes, invaded Kentucky for the sixth or seventh time during the Revolution. And this time they wound up at Bryan Station. They had previously, in a brutal assault upon a station just north of where Bryan Station stood, in 1780, massacred all the people inside. And so an invasion like this was treated with alarm by the settlers. And so here comes this, all these combined tribes and Butler's Rangers. And what do? They conceal themselves in the cornfield and the hemp field. And out from the hemp field, demanding the surrender of the garrison, was Simon Girty. Anyone who fiddles with Kentucky's early history knows of the white Indian Simon Girty, raised by the Senecas, but then became an ally and a leader of the Shawnee, who were a principal tribe in this invasion. And Simon Girty comes out of a hemp field, according to the diarist. So we know there was a huge hemp field there. Out of the hemp field to demand the surrender. And of course, he got a very rude reception from the folks inside the garrison. And that prompted them to try to besiege that fort. Anyway, we won't go into that. But it illustrates to you in 1782, the size of the hemp production in Kentucky was such that you could conceal between it and a cornfield this entire invasion force. It's big.
Wow. Do you have their estimates as far as the size, what the size of that invasion force was?
Well, I would say nearly a 400, 500.
Okay.
About 80 of Butler's Rangers at the most. So you've got that's sizable. Yeah. That could do some damage. And when you only have 40 riflemen inside the fort,
I'm guessing that fort, that station was probably a pretty strategic point. And as far as a piece of critical infrastructure for settlers. So I guess there was probably a pretty gnarly battle there. And obviously I'm not, you know, as you mentioned all these things, I'm not well-versed in history at all. Like most Americans.
Well, you know, what happened ultimately is they gave up the siege. And these are crafty folks now. The Indians and their British allies or provincial allies gave up the siege and began to move north as though they were retreating back toward the Ohio country. And what happened was all these reinforcements were arriving at Bryan Station, one reinforcement of which was commanded by Daniel Boone. And they followed those invaders all the way up to the Licking River. And there the tribes and the Butler's Rangers formed an ambush on either side of this buffalo trace that they were retreating on. Against Boone's wishes, Vogel, against his vocal wishes, they decided to cross the Licking River and attack those people up there. And they just got mauled. Just terrible, terrible. Daniel Boone lost his son, Thomas Boone, in that engagement. The second one of his sons who would die trying to settle the whole Kentucky. So it turned out to be a very sad story in the end. But for Bryan Station, there you have the hemp field.
A huge hemp field.
And you could probably say this with pretty good assurance that wherever there was a settlement in Kentucky, just like wherever there was a settlement in Virginia, you'd find a hemp field. I mean, that's that deep in this country's history.
Yeah, and as far as time frame, you said this was the late 1700s.
Yeah, this 1782.
1782.
Okay. Right.
So where did hemp progress after this? You know, into the 1800s. Is there any major shift, or was it still kind of every major colony, every major settlement had some sort of hemp crop or hemp farm or hemp industry of sorts?
There were, I mean, that it continued well into really the 20th century in many, many regions of the country, including New England, because, I mean, there's where your rope was mostly manufactured for many years up there for the Navy. hemp became almost, in the words of Thomas Jefferson and of John Adams and of George Washington, and by the way, they have great writings about it, those three people. In their words, hemp became a military necessity in America, the raising of hemp. And the reason for it was precisely the reason the British used it for. If we're to outfit a Navy to defend this place, we need hemp because we need the rope. And we need the sails. And it's the only fiber we've got that gives us those.
Yeah.
And so, by the War of 1812, you have an entire American fleet of frigates totally outfitted in hemp, ratlines, halyards, and sails. They say that old Ironsides, the USS Constitution, which you can visit to this day in Boston Harbor. When that ship sailed, it had nearly 80 tons of hemp forming its halyards, ratlines, and sails. If you can imagine, it's incredible. Wow.
Yeah, I just wrote that down. I mean, we talked about that. We talked about that in the last 15 minute segment.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's one of those things that's just mind blowing. You're talking about hemp being just critical to the creation of the U.S. and ultimately
US
military.
You know, here's another fun thing. This is from John Adams. He's from Massachusetts, a member of the Second Continental Congress. He's going to be one of those on what was called the Committee of Form that would draft the Declaration of Independence. On his way to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, John Adams penned a note to himself. And that is, there are two things we need: to declare the independence of the colonies and to encourage the raising of hemp. We're going to get independence, but we need to defend ourselves too. And that's what you use to defend yourself.
Wow. Now, that you said he wrote that note to himself. Is that note still, in a museum right now? I mean, that's...
Yes. Yes.
Wow. That is amazing. Now, question for you. We've mentioned so much about hemp being used for maritime reasons. But my guess is that it was also used for the ground troops, right? For clothing, for back, for gear.
Right.
So you're talking about literally just outfitting your military. Hemp was one of the number one crops.
Right.
To utilize that, right?
Right. And it was also used for paper. You write on it. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin was a huge proponent of hemp. And he published a newspaper. And that newspaper was all published using hemp paper.
Wow. I mean, it's so crazy how all these facts are just lost upon the country as a whole for so long.
Yeah.
Now, would you say, now John Adams basically said it right as far as it being the number two thing, you know, when he wrote that letter to himself, but it seems to me like as far as if you were to rank agricultural crops, whether it's fibrous crops or food crops, that hemp would be in the one, two, or three slot as far as a necessity for the country in the past. Wow. And then we obviously lost that along the way. It's
And you know, you could just look at when I narrated what it was like at Bryan Station. You got all the corn, but then you got all the hemp and then you got flax. So almost we need to eat. Yeah. But we need to clothe ourselves. Which comes first? Well, you'll freeze to death if you don't have the clothes, and you'll starve to death if you don't have the food. So there's no difference. It's equally important that they raise those two crops.
The O-Cannabis Conference and Expo returns to Toronto June 1st through the 3rd, and there are still good booth locations available. This exciting event is free for cannabis retailers and will feature Tommy Chung receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award at the O-Cannabis Industry Awards. For more information about exhibiting or to register to attend, go to ocannabis.com. That's OCANNABIZ.com.
Wow. My mind is blown right now. I mean, I love hearing this stuff. I'm always excited to learn something new. And I feel like every time, I mean, this will be the second time we've talked. I learn a ton. Because this is all stuff that I have no clue about. And just a note, one thing I find interesting is when it comes to history, kids do not like history. I did not like history in school. Now I love history. Now it's like completely flipped 180. Now I turn on some of these documentaries and I am just mesmerized by what we live in today and what we spend our time on, what we waste our time on, what we worry about. When in the past, I mean, everything that you were just mentioning in some of these battles, it's like that was real worry. You know, that was real struggle.
We don't know what worry is.
No,
we really don't.
These days, your internet's out for a half hour, and it's a real struggle in the eyes of, you know, whoever's internet is out. But in the past, I mean, you're talking about struggling to live, to provide for your family, to not get invaded, right?
Right.
Whatever it may be, it's out of control. So it's so interesting.
Yeah, you could be killed at any minute out there in following these people, and many of them were. Mm-hmm. Yet they survived. And you know, we cannot look with too much reverence upon people like that who struggled and made it.
Right. Well, we are ultimately all the descendants of the survivors.
We are people of
battlers in the past.
Right.
Now I want to get to, so part of this very interesting thing, and I don't know how deep we're going to dive into this specifically, is where do things start to turn around for hemp? However, prior to us getting there, I'm curious if you've got any more, you know, interesting facts or interesting situations or battles that took place before that, you know, before things started to turn for hemp in this country.
I'll put it this way. Hemp is a labor intensive crop, which in today's parlance, the one unfortunate thing about labor intensive crops in America, the story of them, cotton is one, tobacco is one, hemp is one, is the type of labor it took to raise those crops. Now, in the early colonial times, the patches of hemp production were much smaller. In Kentucky, they were not enormous fields of hemp, but enough for a family to manage. Some people say that the only reason slavery was ever sustained in Kentucky was because of hemp. We didn't we raise a brand of cotton here, but it's way out in western Kentucky along the Mississippi River. And nowhere in central Kentucky or eastern Kentucky is there any such crop like that. But we did raise hemp. And hemp being labor intensive is the only reason slavery ever was sustained here. So it has that aspect to its old story. After the Civil War and emancipation and the 13th Amendment, when slavery ceased to exist, hemp fell from grace as a plant of choice because there just simply were not enough people to raise it. And it took lots of people to raise. And so by the time of World War I, we get into the early 20th century, hemp has almost ceased to exist as a crop in Kentucky. Wow. There were some patches here and there, but mostly it had ceased to exist. Just like cotton, until the advent of a farm machinery that could go out and mechanically plant it and harvest it, cotton declined as well. And it's made a resurgence significantly, but hemp didn't make a resurgence. And that really got, because it got mixed up with the drug deal, the marijuana aspect to it. That kept it down for a long time until really 2018, when finally the farm bill repealed the former statutes restricting hemp, making it a narcotic, subject to the regulation of the federal government, prohibiting it being raised in 1970 to now reopening it back up. And so hopefully we'll see a resurgence of it. We now have a more mechanized way to handle the planting and the harvesting of it. And it's just like with cotton. And we should see a resurgence of it, particularly in this state.
I definitely believe we are. I mean, I'm seeing it every day, all the time, especially with conversations like we're having right now.
You know,
people that I speak with on the hemp show. They're dedicated. People are passionate about it, not only for the medical benefits, but also for the positive things it can do for the environment, for all the things it can create, you know.
Yeah.
Fibrous this, fibrous that. I mean, I hear things all the time. The hempcrete, things like the cellulose of hemp being used to replace like graphite and Silicon Valley and stuff like that. Obviously, I'm not an expert on any of that.
It is astonishing what they can do with hemp now. I have a friend who, by the way, his companies are among the first commercial sponsors of the Seed and Fiber of Wealth. It's Echo Fiber and Hemp Black. Echo Fiber is headquarters in Georgetown, Kentucky, about 12 miles from Lexington. Hemp Black is a Western North Carolina company. But their president of those companies, Eric Wong, who's a graduate of West Point, a colonel in the Army, a terrific guy. His facility here in Georgetown, they have been a contributor. They're among the early big contributors to the film. And he took me on a tour of his facility, his brand new facility out there. The wallpaper in there is all made of hemp. The carpeting is all made of hemp. All the seat coverings are made of hemp. Everything in that plant is made of hemp. Even the walls, they take that hemp fiber and they can make boards out of it that they use for the walls.
Right.
It's the most amazing thing I ever saw in my life. All made of hemp, everything. So, I mean, it shows you how versatile this plant is. And it's got to make a resurgence.
Right.
Just got to.
It's as if we've been stunting progress for the last, you know, what is it, 70, 80 years. And my guess is that facility is not only sustainable with utilizing hemp everywhere, but also probably going to last a long time.
It's probably going to last a long time. Right. So, I mean, he's into the film because of what it'll do to the general understanding and reception out there in the world about hemp. What the, right. the purpose really is to get it away from the marijuana thing, to get hemp out there for what it is and what it has always been in America. And that is a versatile plant that that provides the country with essential things in its fiber that can be used and then reused. It's a reusable thing that it produces. Yeah, you get a new crop every year. Instead of cutting down trees, why don't we raise hemp? You can make all your boards out of hemp.
And it grows like a weed.
It grows like a weed. It's a fast-growing plant. Yeah.
Yeah, your growth cycle is so fast. You know, I would just guess, and you know, if I look forward, say 20, 30 years from now, I believe that's going to be the case.
I think so too.
Most paper is going to be hemp. Most packaging is going to be hemp. Most goods, there's going to be far more hemp shirts. I mean, I don't know what I'm not sure what the shirt is I'm wearing right now, but it's likely that 20 years from now, this will be the general shirt. Like, hey, it's not cotton. You know, this is a hemp shirt.
Well, now, it'd be nice for you to say, well, Daniel Boone wore a hemp shirt too, which he did.
Daniel Boone's a badass too.
Yeah, that's right.
That's for sure. Now you mentioned, you know, trying to get hemp away from say marijuana. Obviously they're the same plant, and I actually want to kind of bring it back to what we were talking about before, you know, with the history of hemp in the colonies. Right. And, you know, ultimately now, I guess my question here is what documentation is there for say the psychoactive effects of hemp or the smoking of hemp in the past with the colonies, besides just utilizing it for its fibrous properties? You know, what is there in the past history with that?
There's virtually none, really.
Really?
And in fact, I went through a text about hemp that I the history of hemp that I really enjoy. And it's just about Kentucky's experience, written by a James Hopkins, who was a professor of history at the University of Kentucky back in the 1940s and 50s. And he came out with this book, I think in 1951. But he even mentions that, just emphatically, that there is absolutely no evidence that it was ever used by the early settlers here or the colonists in Virginia or anywhere else for reasons other than its fiber. That's it. That's what they raised it for. Mm-hmm. And the rest, they fertilized the ground with, literally, and didn't care about. So the fact that you could take the flower and the leaves and turn it into, and it's marijuana, never entered their minds.
Now, would this be because that specific strain had a very low THC amount in the past, if it was just industrial hemp, and maybe at some point there was a, you know, from another strain from Asia imported that then had a much higher THC content? Like, at what point did things start to shift when it became like, hey, people are smoking it for this reason, and so on, like within the history?
It becomes a phenomenon really of the 20th century. More than anything, you saw it at the end of World War I, and I think most of the historians I have studied on this, particularly Dr. Hopkins, says that really World War I, post years of World War I, are the ones where you saw the plant being used for entertainment, so to speak. One thing I want to do in the film that we envision is to lay out the difference in what we're talking about here. Because I want to make sure our history of this is totally free of all the stuff we see about marijuana. And lay that out right at the beginning and reinforce it at the end. That what we're talking about here is the use of industrial hemp creates a fiber that is as versatile as anything on earth and has been an essential part of the history of this country, not anything else. And so, you know, someone asked me, well, you know, do you want to marijuana, this or that? And I said, I don't even have a position on it. I don't want to even get in it. It's not any of my affair. I don't care. What I want to see is hemp put in the light of its history. I find if you can link yourself, what you do, to something that's deep in the country's history, you feel good about it. You just do. And I find history is one of the great means by which you can create enthusiasm, a desire to become a part of something, if you can tie it to the country's history. This is certainly one of those, because sure, it really is. It's a link to early America, and America all the way up until the 20th century is very deep.
Right. Now, I've always looked at these as two completely separate things, as far as the medical purposes of marijuana / cannabis and the, you know, fibrous or, you know, industrial purposes of hemp. Right. However, you know, this was going to be my next question. You started to kind of answer it briefly there, is that in telling the history of hemp, there is a segment and a time period where it gets completely intertwined, right, with cannabis and marijuana.
It does.
And ultimately it leads to the downfall and the prohibition of hemp due to marijuana. Is that going to be a major segment in the film? And is there anything you can share with us as far as how that process came about?
Well, it came about, there will be. And you almost have to mention that. And of course, it came about, I dare say a lot of it came about through competition with new forms of substances you can use for the purposes for which hemp was usually used for. Synthetic fibers, other types of fibers that, if you encourage the raising of hemp, would become continually a competitor of these new forms, and you see that to a degree in the alarm that came about in the 1930s that resulted in hemp being taxed to a terrific extent, taxed it out of existence. What they did,
yeah,
and then during the 1960s and then to 1970, when they actually banned it by legislation in the Nixon years, it was the rise of the drug culture, and this was one way to address it: just get rid of all of it.
Right,
and then of course by 2016 to 2018, you finally get all that redone, and hemp now made you're capable of legally raising it, and I was proud to say that Kentucky kind of took a lead in that its senior senator was the one who introduced the bill to undo all that, and so that happened, and we're now back at square one, and the question is, do we embrace it as for what it is and move forward with all that it can do? I think we should. And the best way I know how to present that case is to tell its history.
Right, right. And I couldn't help but think of something. Like, if I feel like every year, every few years, there's some sort of new super food, some sort of new super, I don't know, whether it's papayas or pomegranates or whatever, some sort of fruit that people didn't eat for a long time, then, you know, they find out that it's got a lot of medical benefits for different reasons.
Right.
Now, as far as fibrous crops, we're talking about a super crop.
Yeah.
So something that's going to be back in the mainstream as far as, and it's already started, but it's going to get there. So I think 100% people are going to embrace it. But what's extremely important is that the country has a base knowledge of how it got to where it's at, you know, and then how in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was still completely illegal, and ultimately why it got there. So I think that could turn a lot of heads and change a lot of minds, because even to this day, right now, there's still a large segment of the population that believes that it should be completely illegal.
Right. And for what it is not, unfortunately, right. For what it's not.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Although it's got close variations to,
sure.
to other things that scare people, right? The THC side of it.
I'll tell you what's really interesting is that even in the times in the 1930s, when they taxed it almost out of existence, what happens during World War II when the Japanese take over Manila in the Philippines, which was our source of hemp, by the way? The government turns to farmers and say, we want you to grow it. Now, in Lexington, Kentucky, here alone, was the parachute plant where they made parachutes out of hemp for the GIs in World War II.
Wow.
Again, there's parachutes being made out of hemp. So they found it necessary to raise hemp for the war effort. This is 1942.
And that's post-tax, right? Yes, post-tax.
And so there's always been this this contradiction in policy where they want to get rid of it and yet they need it.
Wow.
I think we've grown up enough to know that you take things for what you need, no matter. I certainly hope that's the case. We want to help it be that is what we want.
Right. Right. And when you look at it, like one of the ways I look at it is no matter what it is, it can be abused.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's just there's certain things, right? Like, like cannabis, that it was perceived to be, you know, extremely bad or negative or this and that. And that's why it was there's a lot of other reasons for the prohibition. But one of the ones was it was being abused as a drug, you know, as a psychoactive compound. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about everything right now. I mean, you know, cigarettes got abused. Those got regulated and you know, now they're on the decline, but those got abused. Caffeine gets abused by every day or by people every day, including myself sometimes, even though I'm not one to.
I'm afraid I'm a caffeine abuser.
I mean, there's a lot of, I would just guess, and I'm sure there's statistics out there that we can find that would say something like caffeine's probably the most abused drug in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly, you know, so anything can be abused to some extent. But ultimately, to see the possibilities of the abuse and then completely have that outweigh the benefits on the other side, you know, that is just, it's detrimental to the country as a whole.
Absolutely. No, I agree with that entirely.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? I mean, we talked about some possibilities of the future. Where do we go from here with the documentary film? You know, we talked a bit in our 15-minute segment about where you're at with the processes of that. I want to dive more specifically into that. So, you know, where's it at right now? What all do you need? Where's that going to take you?
If people can go on the website of Witnessing History, you can Google Witnessing History Education Foundation hemp film. You can also Google Seed and Fiber of Wealth hemp film. Either one takes you to the section of the website where we discuss this film. And you'll go through a brief history of hemp with some gorgeous illustrations. Look at those illustrations. You can see how pretty this film would be. Paintings of the USS Constitution fighting the British ship Guerriere. The portraits of Henry Clay. You get a great idea how pretty the film would be by looking at the history and reading the history. And it'll tell you about the basic story of hemp in America. Then you'll see a description of the film itself. And then you'll see a breakdown of the budget for that film. It's about $240,000 to create a film like that, which in most circles of filmmaking is pretty cheap. But we're able to do it for that. And we're able to get these broadcast on public television. And we just finished a film, came out at the end of 2019 on Abraham Lincoln in Illinois. And our partner is Kentucky Educational Television, which is one of the largest PBS affiliates. And KET not only broadcasts our films all the time, but it will take our films and recommend them to the National Educational Telecommunications Association in Columbia, South Carolina. And that's kind of the catalog arm of PBS. It takes films that it thinks are the best that its affiliates produce. And then if it likes them, it will then make those films available to all 247 PBS affiliates in North America, including the one in the District of Columbia and in the Virgin Islands. And the Lincoln film was immediately picked up by NETA. And so it was broadcast on all 247 of the PBS affiliates. And so that's how we get into the PBS system, is we just got to make a film that's excellent enough with its how we make the film. Mm-hmm. All the different aspects of making the film are perfect enough and has a story that they like, which this one will, by the way, right. This one really will, then we'll get a broadcast everywhere. Then we always like to put them up on our YouTube channel and other YouTube channel. Our own YouTube channel has 2 million views, and it's only been up a year and a half.
Wow.
So,
well, you've got an excellent backlog of films and content for that YouTube channel.
Well, thank you very much. Our podcasts are also up there, so people can watch them as they are on our website. It's witnessinghistory.org is the website of the foundation. So, and you can watch all the films and listen to all the podcasts on the website as well.
Excellent. So that's the next step. We got to get this thing funded. We talked in the 15-minute segments about how we're going to get that stuff out. We haven't published that one yet, so that'll be coming out soon. Okay. But we're going to start get that out. We'll get this out as well. Now, okay. I'm curious as far as strategies to make that happen, because I mean, we've got a big reach with hemp businesses. So I'm pretty excited just to see, once we do publish that, what happens. How does that process work for funding if a company or an entity wants to, donate to this project? You know, how does that work?
Like Hemp Black did and Echo Fiber. And we also have a large producer in Montana who has contributed. John Porterfield has contributed to this film. What it takes really is for, if there's an interest for them, by gosh, to give me a call. I like to close those kind of deals. Mm-hmm. And I like to make sure they understand they can do this with confidence. And that when we say we're going to produce a film, by gosh, the film's produced. And but we do need to raise the funding for it. And that's a hard job. But the best way to do it, if it catches someone's fancy and they want to contribute to this, to call me or email me and I'll call them. But I think a good conversation on the phone is a way to start.
Sure. And
if it leads to something else, like a personal visit, we'll talk about that.
Sure. Now I'm on the witnessinghistory.org website, and I clicked the make a gift mm-hmm. button. That took me to the donation page. Would that be one place where
that's one place where you can do it?
Okay.
You can also write a check, and it gives you on the donate page, it gives you the address where it's to be sent.
Okay.
But I would also recommend they give me a call.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the way I look at it is, you're really going to have two different types of donations. You're going to have, individuals or businesses that are doing large amounts, right? Where that should take a conversation. Then you have, someone who may just be listening to the podcast here and want to donate $20.
Sure. You can go right on that donate button.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you considered other platforms in raising at all?
Well, most of it has been through individuals who have already contributed, who are in the hemp industry.
Okay.
I like to see the industry, people in the industry, talk to other people in the industry about it.
Right.
It's the best way to do it. It's like politics. If your neighbor comes over and says, hey, vote for Joe, you give it some serious thought if you like your neighbor. Right. And so I feel that's the best way to do it. And that's why I appreciate a program like this.
Yeah.
Because it really does get to all those people in this industry who have a vested interest in seeing it succeed.
Right. And I know we have our own little schedule on when we publish. I cannot wait to get your episode out because I think it's going to, I think it's going to get a ton of engagement because like I said, I love learning, and anybody that's in this industry and that's in love with the cannabis plant, the hemp plant, you know, I would believe that they would listen to what you're saying and also be super curious about learning more. And then also I look at it this similar way to you look at it is the benefit as a whole. Once this documentary gets produced, how many eyes it will open, how many heads it can turn, you know, and start pushing the country in the right direction.
Right. Right. Well, that's what we want to do.
Right. Now I mentioned, I was just curious about if you've considered any of the other funding platforms. Cause, you know, it'd be interesting if something like this would resonate on like a GoFundMe or a Kickstarter. If those are any things you've ever considered. I mean, those have gotten super popular.
They have gotten super popular. We did try a Kickstarter some time ago, but it was for a film on hemp that was really more related to just Kentucky's role in it. And frankly, so long as if those things are successful, it's because of the people you hired to promote that.
That's exactly what I was going to say next. there's no reason you can't do a campaign on any of those unless you have an entire marketing strategy associated with that campaign and some sort of team running.
And it may be that if we can raise a certain amount of threshold funds that we could turn to something like that. But it takes serious money to do that and to make it successful.
Yeah. That's incredibly true. So that's a very good point. I mean, I know if you were to just make one of those campaigns and send it out into the ether of the internet, it would just gets lost in the noise.
It's just lost.
Very few people see it. And when they see it, it's like they're on to the next thing within 5 minutes.
Right.
Awesome. Well, I think this has been a great conversation. I mean, we've been on for well over an hour here. We're getting to the point where we're going to start wrapping things up. Now, is there anything else you wanted to cover or is there anything specifically you wanted to mention before we jump off here?
No, other than I think we've covered everything. I want people to know that one, we face the production of our films in a way that we try to make each one of them beautiful to look at, entertaining. If you've watched our film on the life of Daniel Boone, most of those scenes are recreated scenes of his so that the viewer doesn't have to try to imagine what it looked like. And many people have had so little introduction to history that they can't really imagine what it is. Right. So what we do is we try to do it for them so that they can see the drama behind what's happened. And you can imagine a scene at, for instance, Bryan Station, where out from a hemp field comes Simon Gurdy. I mean, it's a scene I've dreamed of doing with this film. And then there are just hosts of others, scenes of them harvesting hemp, the breaking of hemp, all those things they vanished from the landscape. And it would be great to see them again.
Yeah. So I haven't watched the story of Daniel Boone. I'll definitely give that one a watch. But what you're talking about is like live action reenactment. So, you're narrating the story, but you're also seeing it, even though it's not the, you know, even obviously there weren't cameras back then. So
No. And the scenes are behind the narration. All behind the narration.
You mean Daniel Boone didn't have an iPhone?
I mean, shame on him, Lord.
Yeah. He was taking selfies during the battle. And
yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I'm living right here in what was his home county. This is where he wanted to stay.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So this is awesome. Yeah. Like I said, I think we're good to kind of wrap it up here. What I'd like to do is in the near future, just schedule some checkups once we get these other, you know, shows published and, you know, start getting the information out there related to donating to the film and stuff. Just some checkups just to see what the progress looks like, you know, if it's getting the funding it needs, you know, are you currently in production? You know, once you start to get into post-production and that thing's ready to be published, like, I want to get you back on here ASAP to.
This is fun. I enjoy being with you. It's great. It's great fun.
Cool. So that's going to wrap it up. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This was a blast.
Thank you for your interest.
Awesome. Very welcome.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey there, my name is Leah Babrudi, and I'm the founder and host of Canna Chicks Podcast, where I discuss cannabis, psychedelics, and other natural medicines. I not only interview people who use them as treatment for different conditions, but also the entrepreneurs who share their knowledge on how they built their businesses. If this sounds interesting to you, give my show a listen. I'm sure you'll learn something that'll surprise you.